Good morning, everybody. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. Kyle High with you this morning. I hope everybody is doing well. 61 degrees outside. And it is now time for Greenside Up. And joining us on the line is Jesse Gilmore from the K-State Extension Office. Jesse, good morning. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. It's been a while since we talked, and you guys are getting pretty close. I think actually next week, or no, not next week, but the week after, I think was when you guys can finally start coming back into studio. So we definitely look forward to that. So before we get started today, you do have a couple of things to talk about today. But before we get to that, let's talk about some of the upcoming events, including there's one happening tonight, correct?
Yes, that's going to be the Community Health Conversations event, specifically for Labette and Montgomery County. It's held online, and it's basically getting some opinions from the community about how coronavirus has affected your health, what barriers to health you've noticed in your communities, and how Labette and Montgomery County can preserve and improve the health of its residents. Registration is on our website, or you can call our office at 620-724-8233 to register. And there are some door prizes for registrants who show up and kind of just give their opinion. So that is happening tonight starting at 6:30.
All right, and then the next thing that is coming up, what is a weekly webinar now, is the K-State Garden Garden Hour.
Yep, that is going to be specifically, well, not always, but mostly horticulture agents from across the state giving webinars on different topics on Wednesdays from noon to 1. Registration is required, and you can find that online. In the Horticulture Info Center of the Horticulture website for K-State. There's going to be many different topics coming up, including wildlife control, hydrangeas in your garden, pesticide safety, and potting media selection for container gardening. If you register and can't end up making the talks, you'll be sent a recording of the webinar. And next week, I will actually be giving a talk on weed management in the lawn and garden, which you will get a brief taste of today in the second half of the show.
All right. So a couple of good things there happening. Of course, the Community Health Conversation happening tonight. You can still register for that. And then the K-State Garden Hour, which is Wednesdays. I do believe that's today. So, but let's go ahead and get into one of our main topics today. And what you wanted to talk about was Dutch elm disease.
Yep. So I am getting a lot of calls to come out and look at trees that seem very distressed. For some reason, there's a lot of dieback in the crown of the tree, and homeowners really down here have a keen eye to spot potential problems in their trees and calling the extension agent in order to come out and diagnose, oh my gosh, is this something I need to be concerned about? And usually in most shade trees, dieback in the canopy is somewhat normal. Obviously, it's not preferred because you want to keep the aesthetic value of the tree up. But it won't typically harm the tree long term, especially if it's a foliar disease, because foliar diseases are kept in the leaves and don't go on to systemically affect the rest of the tree. But with American elms, which are a very common street tree down here, that's not the case. Usually branch dieback in the canopy is a bad sign that it might be infected with Dutch elm disease.
So what is Dutch elm disease, and why is it damaging?
So Dutch elm disease is a fungal wilt. What happens is that the fungus is introduced to random, well, it depends on how it's introduced to the tree, but typically in random branches on the tree, you will start to see some dieback. And there are two different ways that a tree can be infected with Dutch elm disease. The first is through the feeding of the elm bark beetle, which overwinters in the bark of the tree and then flies up to weaker limbs in the tree to feed on the tips of branches. And this fungus is passed from the digestive system of the beetle into those branches, and then it starts making its way inward towards the center of the tree. So you will see random dieback on branches where the beetle feeds, and then progressing inward towards the center. And ultimately, when it's infected, there's really no preventing it from moving throughout the rest of the tree unless you catch it really early. But what happens is that the fungus plugs up the inner wood of the tree where water and sugars move upward, and prevent those resources from getting to the outer parts of the tree, which is why you see the dieback from the leaves. It's because they don't get enough water and sugar. And once it gets to the trunk, essentially it will kill off the tree from starvation. There is another way for Dutch elm disease to spread, and that's through root grafts, where nearby elm trees will have roots that fuse together. And so it passes to from one elm tree to another through the root. And if that's the case, you wouldn't see random branches in the canopy dying back. You would see the lowest branches in the canopy dying back first.
Well, and you say in that, it's hard to stop it from spreading, but are there ways that we can control it before it tries to kill off that tree, basically strangling it to death? Is there ways to try to control it early on?
Yes, if you start noticing branches, random branches in your canopy flagging, there are pruning options to try and control it. Now, I have been on the phone with our plant pathologist on campus about Dutch elm disease because it's been so prevalent in the last 2 weeks. I think I've had 8 different cases of it. And if it's really early, you can try and prune back at least 10 feet below where the symptoms occur. On branches that are flagging or dying back because of this disease, you will see streaking in the wood inside the branches of basically the fungal pathogen, and you have to cut back 10 feet below where you keep noticing the symptoms of that streaking. And that has been reported to be effective, but in our plant pathologist's experience, once the tree has it, it's very hard to get rid of it, like almost impossible. And she's never heard of cases of pruning being effective in keeping the fungus from moving throughout the rest of the tree. So your best option for control is sanitation. If you notice or have confirmed that an elm tree in your area has the disease, it would almost always need to be removed before that disease spreads to other elm trees in the area. One feature of elms is that they are often planted in rows along streets. And so if they're planted close enough together, the disease can spread through the roots or through the elm bark beetle. And getting rid of the wood so that the elm bark beetle can't survive in that fallen wood is also very important because it reduces the chance that the pest that spreads the disease will survive the winter and move on to other elms in the area. So the sanitation of fallen wood, not necessarily the leaves because it doesn't spread through the leaves, but any branches that might fall from the tree should probably be burned or disposed of in some other way.
So yeah, be sure to get rid of those. Don't just let sit on the ground, because then it'll just happen again, and it may actually get worse. And on here that you're talking about is there's some lookalikes to this, correct?
Yes, there are two specific diseases that look a lot like Dutch elm disease. You're going to see some flagging in the canopy that would make me think of Dutch elm disease anyway. The two diseases are called elm yellows and bacterial leaf scorch. The streaking on the inside of the wood is very distinctive of Dutch elm disease, and that's usually what you need to look for when identifying the difference. You can schedule visits for extension agents to come out and look at your trees, typically. I am for Crawford, Labette, Montgomery, and Wilson counties, but every county has at least one Ag and Natural Resources agent who should also have experience in horticulture, a little bit at least, and they should be able to come out and help you diagnose what the problem could be. And if they can't, there's also the option of the plant pathology diagnostic lab on campus. Each land grant should have the option to send in plant samples and confirm whether or not there are any fungal diseases through culture, through culturing potential funguses that are in the plant samples. So the K-State University has one. University of Missouri should have one, the University of Arkansas should have one, and Oklahoma State University should have one as well. And so sending in those samples to each of your land-grant universities can help determine what the disease is and how to best control it and keep your plants looking healthy.
All right. So, again, you can schedule visits to kind of have those diagnose those plant problems. And you did say something there that kind of caught my ear. And you were talking about leaf scorch. So what is leaf scorch, and why do leaves scorch in hot and windy weather?
So there are a couple of different kinds of leaf scorch. The bacterial leaf scorch that I mentioned for American elms is going to be disease-related. It's going to look like the leaves have burnt in the sun, and I'm also getting a lot of calls for, what is not Dutch elm disease, I have been called out to. It ends up being marginal leaf scorch, and it's about trees that have very recently started browning on the tips of upper branches, and on the leaves, the browning is either confined to the outside of the leaves or the tips of the leaves. And that's going to be an environmental problem. So when leaves are exposed to hot, windy weather very quickly, they go through what's known as transpiration, where they basically pass off water through the leaves, and the water evaporates out of a part of the leaf called the stomata, which can be thought of as the pores of a leaf. And so this water evaporates, and because the wind is keeping the air around these leaves consistently dry and hot, it functions a lot like sweating in people, where the leaves continually lose this water faster than it can replenish it from the soil, especially if there hasn't been a rain recently or there hasn't been any supplemental irrigation from the homeowner. So irrigation is the best way to prevent marginal leaf scorch from happening in your trees, specifically in weeks like we've had recently where there's been little to no rain.
Yeah, and we had a little bit last week, but you know it's been so little over the past month, basically, where you could see that happening. And what kind of trees are showing the most signs of marginal leaf scorch?
So, overwhelmingly, there's two types of trees that have been showing symptoms of marginal leaf scorch. The first is ornamental pears, of which there are quite a few. Those are going to be parallel with the length of the leaf on the outside of the leaves or the margin. And maples are also showing some symptoms of marginal leaf scorch, not as much as ornamental pears, but on maples, that's going to be the upper half of the leaf instead of the outside edges. So it's interesting that it shows a little differently on maples compared to pears, but in both cases, the solution is going to be the same.
And last part on the marginal leaf scorch, of course, you told us how to prevent it. The best way to do it is, a lot of irrigation because of the lack of rain. What are the effects of MLS, though? What are the long-term effects on it?
So, in short periods, the long-term effects of marginal leaf scorch are going to be very low. The leaves themselves turning brown is not the primary problem with marginal leaf scorch, but instead it's going to be a symptom that the tree is not getting enough water typically for these hot, windy conditions where it's going to need a lot of water to replace the water that evaporates out of the leaves. And with that, you would irrigate the tree so that It has some supplemental water just in case we continue to go through those extended periods of hot, windy weather.
All right. So, again, those talking about Dutch elm disease this morning and also marginal leaf scorch. What we're going to do here, Jesse, we need to go ahead and take a break. But when we come back, we'll talk about watering new plantings. And also, we'll also talk about weed management in the lawn and garden. We'll talk to you here in a few minutes. Jesse, we do have to go ahead and go to a break right quick, though.
Okay, all
right.
Good.
All right, thanks a lot. Jesse Gilmore from the K-State Extension Office. Just hang on there, and we'll get back to you here in just a few minutes. We do have a break coming up. We will restart Greenside Up at about 8:10. First, we have some news and weather. We're going to get to you here in just a few minutes. You are listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF here on this hump day morning. It is currently 61 degrees outside. Welcome back to the Mighty 690 KGGF. Kyle High with you this morning. And it is time to restart Greenside Up. And joining me on the phone is Jesse Gilmore. Jesse, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Before we get started on our two other topics real quick, let's just kind of go over, again, a couple of webinars happening. And including one of them happening tonight is the Community Health Conversations.
Yep, Community Health Conversations is a talk with Labette and Montgomery County residents about how we can about how the counties and K-State Research and Extension can better help support you in your road to good health, and how coronavirus has impacted your health journey throughout these last 6 months. It is an online webinar at 6:30 p.m. Registration is on our website or through calling our office at 724-8233. And there will be some door prizes available for people who come in and are willing to give their opinion.
Absolutely. So, again, that is going to be tonight at 6:30. You can still go onto the website and register for tonight. And also the weekly webinar, the K-State Garden Hour.
Yep, K-State Garden Hour is on Wednesdays from noon to 1 via Zoom. Registration is required, and you can do that online at the Horticulture Info Center on K-State's website. There are many different topics offered by horticulture agents throughout the state and other specialists that apply to horticulture topics. There is going to be wildlife control, pesticide safety, hydrangeas, and potting media selection for container gardening. If you can't register and make the talks, you will be sent a recording of the webinar. And next week, I will be giving a talk on weed management in the lawn and garden. But since I know that some people won't be able to make that, I was going to do this half of the talk on that particular presentation in some ways that you can control or live with weeds in your lawn and garden.
All right. And again, also with that webinar, if you register but can't make the talks, you'll be sent a recording of that webinar so you can check it out at your convenience later on. And we'll go ahead and get to the weed management here in just 1 second. We do want to kind of wrap up what we were talking about earlier, but we're talking about watering new plantings.
Yep. So marginal leaf scorch has been an issue in shade trees around the area. It's where water is taken out of the tree faster than it is replaced, and the outside of particular leaves in the tree canopy start to turn crispy and brown because of that water difference between the atmosphere and the plant. And so watering, especially new trees, is incredibly important to ensure that they are as unstressed as possible, and that they develop a good, healthy root system early in their lives. Watering in new trees is going to be slightly different from watering mature trees, and sometimes watering mature trees isn't even required. But with new trees, you want to make sure that you water deep and infrequently in periods of extended dryness, like we've had in the last 2 weeks, in order to ensure that the roots will penetrate the soil profile deeper in search of water stores. So about once a week, you want to give a new tree, a good 3 to 5 minute long soaking to encourage that root growth.
And so, again, get some deep waterings for it. The other thing is mature trees, though, won't require the same amount of water, correct?
Yes, because they have deeper root systems, they will be able to look for more water in the soil profile compared to what new trees would, and they will be able to replenish the loss of water that they are experiencing in these hot, dry conditions right now a lot more efficiently than new trees will. So in most cases, you won't need to water mature trees unless they are a water-thirsty species like birches or willows or poplars. We have had a couple of poplars, which are in the aspen family, and aspens grow at higher altitudes and cooler temperatures, so they are not quite as acclimated to the hot, dry summers that we have down here and will require additional watering.
All right, and you want to get to your main presentation here. As you're listening to Greenside Up, we have Jesse Gilmore on from the K-State Extension Office. And your main presentation now is weed management in the lawn and garden.
Yep. So I'm sure at least a few people listening have heard the quote about how a weed is a plant whose virtues have never been discovered. Some people might have also heard the quote that a weed is a plant that has never learned to grow in rows. Everyone's definition of weed will be a little different based on what kind of perspective they bring to it and the priorities they have for what and where they're growing. Specifically for perspectives, you could be a homeowner, you could have pasture land, you could have cropland. And then priorities, in most cases, I find that a person's tolerance to weeds is basically their tolerance for inconsistency in whatever they're trying to plant. The more tolerance they have for weeds, the less adamant they are that everything needs to be consistent in their field or lawn or garden bed. Weeds will typically span a continuum, or plants in the garden will span a continuum. If they are undesirable for the most part, they're weeds. Plants that you may not have put there but have ornamental value could be considered wildflowers. And then there are the straight ornamentals that you put there intentionally for the sake of aesthetic. When it comes to controlling weeds, it is important to understand a weed's biology. There are three main characteristics when figuring out how to control weeds that you need to know. The first is the length of life. Is it an annual or is it a perennial? Annuals will die back at the end of the year, and that might make it seem like you can leave them, but they are usually, because of that one-year cycle of life, prolific seeders. And if you let the annual weeds go to seed, you will have an infestation at some point, whereas perennials will come back year after year, but usually won't seed as frequently and spread around the rest of your lawn or garden. There's also the season of growth. There's cool season, which grow in the spring and fall, and then there's warm season, which grow in the summer. And this is helpful for identification of different weeds. And then method of growth. Oftentimes, weeds will be just a single plant, but they can also reproduce through rhizomes, stolons, vines. They can also be shrubs and trees, or they can be herbaceous. And each of these growth characteristics will affect the management strategy you have. So what I'm about to say is probably blasphemous for a horticulture agent, but I am a big fan of letting weeds grow where they fall. Now, in the lawn, obviously, this isn't feasible because of city ordinances, and even in rural areas, you might not want weeds in your lawn. But I find that letting weeds grow has a lot of pros that other control options might not have. Some weeds can be used as a food source. Some weeds attract beneficial insects and pollinators. Some weeds have pest prevention qualities. Some weeds fix nitrogen, like clover, and it is the lowest cost and labor commitment out of any potential control option, even if it itself is not a control option. There are some drawbacks to letting weeds grow, though, that need to be taken into account. It does create an inconsistent look in your lawn or garden. At high enough population, it can cause disease pressure in ornamentals. So keeping ornamentals clear of weeds is important. It can also serve as a potential pest host, and all the time it will be a light, water, and nutrient competitor, and in some rare cases can also cause allergies. But I am a huge fan of letting it grow, specifically for the edibility. Dandelion, lamb's quarters, and purslane are probably the three most common edible weeds. And dandelions in particular are very good for you. I will stick up for that plant until I die. But for those people who do want consistency in their field, lawn, or garden, you do have several control options as well. Those would specifically be to pull it or spray it. In larger fields, pulling it is not going to be feasible in terms of labor, so spraying is your best option. But in most lawn and garden situations, pulling it is going to be your best option. And then you can also prevent weeds from growing in the future through landscape fabric or mulch, cover crops, and ground cover ornaments.
So when well, I was going to talk about, you're talking about pulling weeds. After you pull a weed and say the root comes up, is it best to kind of cover up that area that where the weed was at with, back with maybe some soil there? Or is it best to kind of just leave it the way it is right there? Because I don't know if a weed could actually grow back there. Would you need to spray that area just to make sure or what?
Well, usually, especially with annual plants, they don't have deep roots. And so you will not need to fill in the hole that you leave unless you want a flat garden bed. Typically, perennials will have deeper tap roots. And so if you don't get the entire root, like with dandelions are notoriously hard to pull, it would be beneficial to fill it in to keep the whatever root might be left in the ground from growing back. Pulling is the highest time commitment for any type of control. Obviously, you have to be physically able in order to get out and, you know, bend over and pull these weeds. And there are some people who are not physically able to get out and move around like that. So pulling is not a good control option for people who might have limited mobility. Mm-hmm. Some weeds, like I mentioned before, won't pull easily, and pulling some weeds with specific growth habits, like rhizome, will make weed infestations worse. But there are some pros to pulling it in that it's the cheapest form of control. It's exercise for people who want it, and you can be selective in what goes and what stays if you find that some weeds are desirable. The other control option is spraying with some form of herbicide. I personally do not recommend spraying in most cases just because of the potential injury that can happen to other plants in the area. But it is the fastest control method, and oftentimes it is the most effective control method unless we develop some sort of herbicide resistance. It is also the easiest control method for those with limited mobility. But in most cases, in addition to being someone who likes weeds and likes the more natural growth, spraying pesticide, specifically herbicide, can cause herbicide injury or drift onto desirable plants. There can be side effects without using the correct personal protective equipment. You do potentially run into herbicide resistance with weeds, and if you spray and it ends up raining, you can have herbicide runoff into other parts of your yard. So my tip for anyone interested in spraying weeds is to understand the biology of the weed and understand what you're spraying. The label is the law, and you should always follow the label. And I highly recommend signing up for the July 22nd K-State Garden Hour, which is specifically on pesticide safety and how to read and understand pesticide labels, which includes herbicide. That will give you a lot of good information on what to look for in herbicide labels and how to determine what to spray. But spray on dry days and then allow the herbicide to evaporate, and in most cases it should kill off whatever weeds you want to get rid of.
And probably the best time to spray, like you say, do it on dry days, but kind of find an area where it looks like there may not be rain for a few days. That'd probably be the best time to spray, correct?
Yep. You do have to be careful with wind, especially in liquid herbicide. There are There are solid herbicides, pelletized herbicides, but these are more likely going to be pre-emergent herbicides that won't control weeds that are already there. So 9 times out of 10, the herbicide that you spray on a weed that already exists is going to be a post-emergent herbicide and can drift on, and it's going to be a liquid, so it can drift in wind over to other plants in your garden. And that's something you have to be careful of.
Absolutely. So you were about to say something else before I asked the question about pulling up the plants. I'm not quite sure where you were about to go to, but maybe you can help me remember a little bit what you were about to talk about there, just as I was asking about pulling up those weeds.
I was about to go into a little bit of edibility on weeds. I am the forager type. I would honestly consider this my soapbox in that if there's a plant with a use in your yard or garden, even if, you know, it might be a little weird. When I started eating weeds out of my backyard, there was this kind of hesitation on my part because I didn't put the plant there specifically for food. So it was a little uncomfortable going from these plants that I put there specifically for food, like tomatoes and peppers and stuff like that, and going to dandelions, which I had never seen as having a use before. It's a lot of fun finding uses for plants that you didn't know had uses before, and understanding what kind of weeds you have in your garden and what their potential benefits might be gives a lot of people a more positive outlook on the plants that they might otherwise be annoyed with. I do have 2 quick suggestions for anyone who is interested in going for the more wild edible types. Never eat a plant you cannot 100% identify. That's just common sense, and it's a good way to keep yourself safe. And 2 is, even if you do want to eat plants that you've never tried before, introduce them to your diet slowly so that you can understand how they affect you, and basically give your body a chance to acclimate to the new food. But there are some good resources out there for anyone who might be interested in, you know, finding edible weeds in their lawn or garden. I have those for you if you're interested. Just give me a call at our office or send me an email.
All right. And what are the numbers that they can contact you at? And what is your email? That way they can contact you.
Sure. So our office phone number is 620-724-8233. And my email address is jr637@ksu.edu.
All right, Jesse, thank you so much for coming, calling in today and letting us know about all these different things, the Dutch elm disease, the marginal leaf scorch, and also weed management in the lawn and garden. This will be up on our website here in a little bit in case you missed any of it. But again, Jesse, I appreciate you coming on today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you very much. You have a good day.
You too.
All right. Jesse Gilmore from the K-State Extension Office. We appreciate him calling in. I do believe next week is going to be our last week where the K-State Extension agents will be calling in. I do believe on the 8th they're allowed to return back to studio, which we do look forward to that. But we still have one more week of them being out, basically just calling in for the show. But we'll get back to them coming back in studio. Definitely look forward to that. All right, we're going to go ahead and take a break. When we come back, we're going to start at Open Line. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF here on this hump day.